Nipana Sacharama Samstapaka Loka Namita Karana Tribhuvane Manya Sharanya Kara Radha Krishna Padara Vinda Bhajana Nandana Mata Liko Vande Rupa Sanatana Raghu Jaga Sri Jiva Gopalaka.
I offer my respectful obeisances unto the six Goswamis, namely Sri Sanatana Goswami, Sri Rupa Goswami, Sri Raghunath Bhatta Goswami, Sri Raghunath Das Goswami, Sri Jiva Goswami, and Sri Gopal Bhatta Goswami, who are very expert in scrutinizingly studying all the revealed scriptures with the aim of establishing eternal religious principles for the benefit of all human beings. Thus, they're honored all over the three worlds, and they're worth taking shelter of because they're absorbed in the mood of the gopis and are engaged in the transcendental loving service of Radha and Krishna. Sri Shad Goswami Prabhu Ki Jaya. So we're going to go on today to chapter 5. This will be quite a brief class, I predict, because it's a short chapter for one thing. And I only found out we were going to have this class at about 8 o'clock last night, so I haven't really been able to prepare so much. It's following on from chapter 4. Chapter 4 was dealing with karma and jnana and how it is that the devotees reject karma and jnana because of their absorption in Krishna consciousness in different ways. So many nice verses were quoted, and the various people speaking the verses were saying that because I like chanting, because I get such a taste out of chanting the glories of the Lord, therefore I'm not interested in karma and jnana. Because I get so much out of serving the lotus feet of the Lord, therefore I'm not worried about karma and jnana. And you just ask them to be quiet. Well done. Thank you. I hope it stays like that for a while. Okay, so yeah, the basic idea was that the devotees speaking the verses were appreciating Krishna consciousness in different ways, different aspects of Krishna consciousness. So, and they were getting so much, such a relishable experience being engaged in Krishna consciousness in all those ways, that they weren't worried about karma and jnana. Karma and jnana, bhukti and mukti, dharma arta, karma and moksha, these are all different ways of looking at the same thing, basically. So the devotees were not interested. And as we noticed as we read through some of them yesterday, some were focusing on jnana, some on karma, some on both. Some also included yoga. So it was quite a mixture of these materialistic things that the devotees weren't worried about. In this chapter 5, it's more or less, focusing on the karma side. Therefore the chapter's entitled The Purity of Devotional Service, meaning there's a lack of, there's no maya, no material attractions are there, basically, or no material disturbances, no material considerations, just purely spiritual considerations only. So we'll just go briefly through it. I don't think there's much we can do about these children, is there? Just let them be children until they burn themselves out. Yeah, the break will be finished in a minute. You guys never used to do this, did you? Anyway, look, we know it's natural, so we don't worry about it too much. Okay, so the thing is that devotional service is transcendental to everything material. Doesn't matter about country, class, society, circumstance, birth, or anything. As long as the person is actually serious about Krishna consciousness, all these things become meaningless, irrelevant. So in this way, everyone has an equal opportunity in devotional service, whatever their history is, whatever's there in the past. So this is more or less, this point is going to be discussed. So the first example given is of the caste Goswamis or the caste Brahmins, that type of person. Type of person who thinks that by birth you are automatically ordained with a certain spiritual position, and literally come hell or high water, you can't lose it, even if you try. Even if you try your level best to disqualify yourself, you can't. You are permanently like that. So, Prabhupada's giving the example of the Nityananda Vamsas. They're still existing. They are descendants of not Lord Nityananda, but disciples of his son, Virabhadra. But because there's a little confusion, at least in some people's minds, they think that they're actually descended from sons of Virabhadra. But they're not. They're descended from disciples. In fact, we have some here in Vrindavan. In fact, probably some of you know the people down at Shringarvat or Nityanandavat, which is a nice temple, nice place, nice deities of Gaurnatai. And when you go up in front of the altar on the left, if you can read Hindi, then you see there's the family tree. And at the top is Lord Nityananda. And then there's Virabhadra, and then is the chap who's on the altar. The one I know, his name is Dhruva. And he's a friendly sort of chap. They take it in turns, doing the puja. When he's not doing the puja, he's a clerk in the magistrate's court in Mathura. Householder has to do something to maintain himself. But anyway, traditionally these people, they're staunchly opposed to the idea that anyone can become a Brahmin or a Goswami. Even if they're coming from bad backgrounds, they can still become elevated in this lifetime to such a high position. And, you know, the problem with that for the caste Goswamis and caste Brahmins is that then these people, then they get competition. Then there's competition. They can't just do what they like and be very popular and live very affluently and very comfortably. They have to get themselves together. Which, anyway. So Prabhupada points out that Srila Bhakti Siddhanta particularly struggled with these people. Prabhupada says there was a great hard struggle. You might find it hard to imagine, but some of these people, we're talking about this century, in perhaps, the, I guess, the 20s or early 30s, something like that. Some of, say, the grandparents or so, parents, grandparents, whatever, of the existing pundits in the main temples we go to, tried to kill Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. And if not, those who weren't actually involved in that conspiracy, they at least closed all the doors of the temples. Now just imagine us, we're ISKCON, and particularly those of us who are Westerners, we can appreciate that for them it may well be a little hard to digest. But they were revolting heavily against Indian people who were initiated by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati and were in the position of Brahmins, even though they may have been born Sudra or whatever. So they all the temples, like you go to Radha Damodar, Radha Raman, and generally the priests and people are pretty friendly, and you know they're often quite nice. But just a few years ago, not long ago, when Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati came through with his disciples, they locked the doors. And would you believe, even the merchants in Loy Bazaar, they all closed their shops. They wouldn't even do business with them, because they thought, you know, this is contamination. So the times have changed. Therefore you can understand how Prabhupada said that in Jagannath Puri, we can expect that sooner or later they'll let the devotees in. Because, you know, I mean, it's a similar situation. They're very strongly opposed, but they're probably not going to kill you. They won't let you in if they know you're an ISKCON devotee. So just give them some time and whatever, and then they'll probably welcome us with open arms. I don't know if it'll be in our lifetimes, but it won't be too long. Anyway, the thing is, this is one of the... We're talking here about karma, material considerations, which don't interfere actually with devotional service, in fact. But the thing is that many people think they do. That you can't really be a devotee, or a Brahmin, or a Goswami, or a Guru, or whatever it may be. You can, until you take a suitable birth. In fact, Prabhupada, when our devotees first came here back about, say, what, 20 odd years ago, 25, 24 years ago, a couple of devotees went to one of the very popular temples, and they were chanting their japa, quite peacefully and nicely, and the pujari, caste Brahmin or caste Goswami, saw them while he was offering the arati, and he was appreciating. They're chanting Hare Krishna nicely, and they're peaceful like that. So he came and said, you know, you're doing very nicely, it's wonderful. I'm really appreciating. If you just carry on like this, then in your next life, you can be born as Brahmins, and then you can worship the deity, and that'll be really good. So the devotees didn't know what to say, but they came back and told Prabhupada that this is what happened. And Prabhupada said, no, this is wrong. This man has it wrong. What you should have told him is that if you do your puja very nicely, then in your next birth you may be born in ISKCON. And then you can really make an advancement in spiritual life. Anyway, I don't think we really need to go into the subject too much. It's a well-known point. But the point is there. So Prabhupada continues at the bottom of page 47. It's on the basis of the activities of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta. And Prabhupada himself was pushing the point very strongly again and again and again. It's strictly a matter of qualification, and it's not a matter of birth. Again and again and again. So as a result of that, Krishna consciousness is now available, openly available to us, to everyone, to anyone. So what's the procedure? Well, this is explained in the next couple of few paragraphs, going down page 48, going over onto the top of page 49, that the main thing which causes this change, so a person can genuinely be accepted as a genuine Brahmin and not just rubber stamped or Goswami like that, is that one has to be connected to the disciplic succession. One has to be initiated by a bona fide spiritual master. Of course, and Prabhupada explains, it doesn't just end with that you just get initiated and then you're there. You're now the Paka Brahmin number one. No. You have to apply yourself very seriously to the process. In fact, what some of these people don't like, and they have a point, to some extent they definitely have a point, is when they see the ISKCON devotees or some of them, particularly like... Anyway, just say some ISKCON devotees behaving in a way which isn't very good.
Yeah, you know, like yelling and screaming, someone wearing saffron, sharing a rickshaw with a Mataji, things like this. And even, you know, some of them are very finickety, eating with the left hand, things like this. Not obviously not knowing what is clean and what is not clean, and picking up something unclean. Official status, you just get initiated and then you're just qualified and you have to be accepted. One has to become connected. In other words, one has to really take shelter of the spiritual master, take shelter of the process and learn, like a student, learn and apply. And then in this way, a real transformation of character, which can be observed by anyone and appreciated by any honest person, that will happen. Some of our devotees way back in those days, they were sannyasis, sort of. Anyway, they were officially sannyasis at least. Prabhupada was giving them a chance. So they went to South India, and their idea was, let's debate with the Brahmins. So they came in and they started. The first question they asked was, do you guys know what's the difference, but what are the three features of the Absolute or something, you know, which a good South Indian Brahmin would know, but in such a way that the people were thinking, now, who are these people actually? So we do have to be a little careful to learn and manifest and not just think that, oh, I'm a Brahmin because I have this thread, or, you know, I'm a devotee, therefore they must accept me. Whatever I do, if I scream at the rickshaw driver or, you know, do something silly, then still, you know, they must accept me. So this is very important. Then, we're now at page 49, the next paragraph. Point is made, very nice point, that for a devotee, someone who's a genuine devotee, even if somehow they fall down, something goes wrong, but the normal material principles which apply when a person falls down from a higher position, they don't apply. Meaning, if you are like a mundane Brahmin, but then you get involved in some illicit activity, breaking one of our regulative principles, which proper Brahmins would certainly follow, even if they're materialistic. So if he breaks a regulative principle, then he has to perform. There's a system he has to go through so he can recover his position. Otherwise, he won't be allowed to take the position of Brahmin again. So that's called prayaschita. And it's a whole sort of ceremonial procedure. Down in Sri Rangam, did you Gurukul people go to Sri Rangam? Not, eh? Anyway, there's the family there. When Lord Chaitanya went to Sri Rangam, he stayed with, we mentioned the other day, Venkata Bhatta, Gopal Bhatta, Goswami, who was at the time a child, and Prabodhananda Saraswati was there. He's also a great, great devotee. So Lord Chaitanya stayed there. Now, there are descendants of those people still living and still doing exactly the same thing 500 years later in Sri Rangam. And they're quite nice. There's one youngish fellow, meaning he's probably not more than 30, and his name is Nandakumar Bhatta. And he's very nice. If you go there, he is in the Lakshmi temple there. Lakshmi and Narayan have separate temples. So he's pujari there in the Lakshmi temple, and as soon as he sees ISKCON devotees, even though there's always a lot of people there, he pushes everyone aside and brings the ISKCON devotees to the front and explains everything, and, you know, he doesn't want any money or anything like that. He's just very nice. So his brother, I think, or uncle or somebody, immediate relative, for some reason or another, he was also a Brahmin there, doing some puja. They have many, many temples. Then he committed the sin or whatever you'd call it, contaminating activity of going to America. He crossed the sea. So for 12 years, he was not allowed on the altar when he came back. For 12 years. Then eventually they let him back on. So this is the idea. This is like a mundane standard. But the idea is that according to the normal principles of material life, if you fall down from any position, you can't just get back up and occupy the same position. Either you remain fallen, or you have to elevate yourself through some procedure. But when you're a devotee, you don't have to do that. All you have to do is start doing those, say, brahminical activities again. Krishna conscious activities again. This is basically all you have to do. And Prabhupada says, this is the mystery of the Vaishnava cult. Very mysterious. Let's see. Then, we're just about at the end actually. The next and I think last point I'll make is the idea comes up like right at the bottom of page 49. Even if someone fails to execute their duties, but they're fully surrendered to Krishna, then they don't have to worry. Their position is secure. This type of idea. Any debts you may have, like, let's see, page 50, in the third paragraph. This is confirmed also in the 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. So the verse says that, my dear Uddhava, any person who takes shelter of me in complete surrender and follows my instructions, giving up all occupational duties, is to be considered the first class man. Then the next paragraph, that if someone gives up his occupational duties and completely surrenders to the Lord, then he is no more a debtor. He has no more obligation. And there's a number of quotes here which are basically making this point. Normally, by material standards, we're indebted. But if you take to Krishna consciousness, you're no longer indebted. So we might think, well, that's very convenient. Because otherwise, you know, you have many debts in terms of your karma. Krishna says sarvadam parityaja and so on. Then no more karma. So you think, oh great, no more karma. No more obligations to your parents or the demigods or the forefathers or anyone, society. But that depends. Depends on if you really take shelter of the Lord. If you half take shelter of the Lord, then you still remain implicated. So these considerations apply only when you've fully surrendered. And if you haven't fully surrendered and the obligations still apply, how will you be able to tell? This is a very interesting idea. What would you say, Arjun? You'll tell because you'll still remain attracted to material existence. You'll still remain attracted. If you're so absorbed in devotional service that you've actually become free, then you'll essentially be on the transcendental platform. You won't be feeling the pangs of material existence any longer. So, like, some people, they come and join the temple, but after a while, they find that they can't make it, can't handle it in the temple. It's too restrictive or something of that sort. And they feel they need some of their own space and more freedom to do what they like. So this indicates, first of all, obviously it indicates they're not fully surrendered and that they're not absorbed in Krishna consciousness. But it also indicates that they're still obliged materially. even ourselves, we're following Varnashram. If you're completely absorbed in Krishna consciousness, then along with your karma and your obligations to your parents and so on, any need for Varnashram goes completely out the window also. Therefore, up until the time of Bhaktisiddhanta, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, there was only one ashram in Vaishnavism, and that was Paramahamsa. There were no brahmacharis. There was just Paramahamsa, which is actually the last stage of sannyas. It's beyond sannyas, in like what our application of sannyas. But the problem occurred that people weren't ready for it. So you had all these babajis and babajarinis, perhaps, female babajis, falling down. And so therefore we know Bhaktivinoda Thakur made the point that at his time, like at the end of the last century, 100 years ago or 120 years ago, Vaishnavism had a very bad name as being like either a beggar's excuse for making a living or an opportunity to engage in illicit sex life in the name of being supposedly religious. Because the whole idea was that if you're going to be a devotee, then you start at the highest level. You become a babaji. But unless you have become purified through complete and progressively increasing absorption and devotional service, if you try to assume a position which is beyond you, then you'll fall down. But if you stay on the level, even though it's a lower level, it may not be so sort of prestigious or like that. But if it's a level you can function on, then you'll make advancement and gradually you'll be elevated. So this is an interesting point about karma. So, let's see. Like it says over on page 52, up towards the top there, there's additional evidence in the Agastya Samhita. As the regulative principles of scripture are not required by a liberated person, so the ritualistic principles indicated in the Vedic supplements are also not required for a person duly engaged in the service of Lord Ramachandra. So all these regulative principles, which means Varnashram, particularly Varnashram actually, and so many others, they're not required for a liberated person. But if you're not a liberated person, then they are required. Then again, you see the way Prabhupada applied Varnashram. It was very clever. It's not rigid Varnashram. If it was, then our movement and our activities as devotees in our different ashrams would be different from what they are. But Prabhupada applied it very cleverly so that along with giving the protection from the material nature which it's intended to do, but also at the same time, through not applying it too rigidly, the devotees are able to render devotional service to Krishna in a, you could say, somewhat flexible manner, although within the context of Varnashram, and therefore make advancement in a very nice and natural way in Krishna consciousness. Do you follow this point? What do you think, Arjun? You follow? Abhimanyu, you follow? Where's our Krishna Das, by the way? He's not well? I see. Okay. Okay, so that's about as far as we intend going today. Just one other thing we'll mention, yes, important point. This is like the essence, one part of the essence of the subject. In the last paragraph, this is the 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, Karabhajana Muni, that a person who's a devotee, if by chance or mistake they do something wrong, then one of the reasons they don't have to go through any prayaschitta is because Krishna is very kind to the devotees. Krishna is very kind. But he's not so kind to the Karmakandiya people or those who are following yoga, Karma Yoga, Ashtanga Yoga, if they should fall. Can any of you think of a verse from Bhagavad Gita? in which Krishna himself expresses this mood of his? And someone else can tell us the meaning? Vikram? Yes, sort of. I mean, that's like a little bit vague translation. Thing is, it's not that if someone's abominable, but if someone does abominable action, then as long as they remain engaged in, can you think what the Sanskrit term is here? Engaged in ananya bhakti. Ananya bhakti. As long as they remain engaged in undeviating devotional service, and they don't just go off the deep end and just become absorbed in a lifestyle of sinful activity, but as long as they really remain engaged in devotional service, then they must be considered saintly because they're properly situated. We're going to discuss that verse sometime next week in Bhagavad Gita and some very nice points there. But one of the points which we can just mention now is that if a karmakandiya person or just a regular materialist or a hatha yogi, ashtanga yogi or people of these different types, if they do abominable action, then what happens to them? Are they then to be considered saintly immediately? No, they go to hell. They go to hell because they have to take their reactions. But for the devotee, just by continuing on in devotional service, devotee is considered saintly. So just see the difference between the devotee and the non-devotee, even some sort of higher grade non-devotee like karmakandiya person or a yogi. Such a big difference. And what does it depend on? Krishna's mercy to his devotees. So, yes, sir.
That
Not necessarily unknowingly, but just momentarily, in a moment of weakness, something like that. Yes. Abominable activity. Yeah.
Very practically, for neophyte devotees, like myself and the others, what is our position then to what all this ritualistic and duties we have, for example, the forefathers and
Well, the point is that while one is, particularly while one is living in a temple and is full-time engaged in devotional service, even though one may not be very advanced, but at least one is making one's best effort, then one doesn't really have obligation. If one is in a position where one is not so fully engaged in devotional service, then you know, to actually make a calculation on how much responsible they are or not responsible would be very hard. But the point is that to whatever degree people are more involved on the material level, then, you know, to that degree they're more, got to be more mindful about these other responsibilities. Otherwise they'll get reaction. They'll definitely get reaction. Yeah. Oh, to one's parents, the forefathers, society or the government, and, you know, the sun, the moon, other living entities. Oh, you have to do pinda, for example. Pinda. For your forefathers, you have to worship the demigods, just like Krishna. there's a system for householders called, I think, Pancha Yajna, if I'm not mistaken. And in the Krishna books, Prabhupada explains when Narada Muni is visiting Krishna in Dwaraka, in different palaces, Krishna was doing different things. In one place, he was in one palace, he was doing this sacrifice. So this is to the main deities, like the sun, and I actually don't even know all of them, but the sun is definitely one of them. The main deities who are helping one in one's life generally. So that's a standard thing for householders.
Or even in Western countries, you find in Switzerland, for instance, army is compulsory.
Right.
But if you are a priest, you can't be exempted from that. Maybe that could be in that kind of a...
Yes, that somehow or other they're applying the idea, right. Anyway, the thing is, you know, it's a little hard to be terribly specific about how it's applied, but the basic principle is like that. And it's explained that, for example, Bharat Maharaj and Maharaj Yudhisthira, they used to do those sacrifices to these demigods. Now, they were actually on that elevated platform of pure devotional service, even though they're householders and like that. So they didn't really have to. But because the majority of people, even though they, as Krishna-conscious kings, were directing the people in Krishna consciousness, but still, because the people in many cases were not very advanced, so they understood that they still need to do some of these activities. So to set an example that for them, they would worship demigods. Within their minds, they would do it, seeing those deities as like parts and parcels of Krishna. So it wasn't exactly demigod worship in that sense. That's a good point, yes. It's for the householders. See, Prabhupada, it's for householders in general. It's like a very general principle. There's a very interesting conversation which I just saw recently. Some account I just saw recently. One devotee was explaining what happened when he got married. Prabhupada was there, maybe Prabhupada arranged it all. And he and his wife asked Prabhupada, what are our duties now as householders? Prabhupada said the same thing. You must be ready to feed everyone before you eat. So they thought, well, you know, they were expecting something a little more exotic sounding. So then they thought, well, let's ask him again a little later. So they asked him again. And Prabhupada gave exactly the same answer. Yeah. Because, anyway, like a householder is a position which you could say where a person, it really depends. It really depends. Like if one's a brahmachari or vanaprastha even, particularly brahmachari or sannyasi, then it would generally be much more clear, at least what is the general idea. That the general idea is just to try to be fully engaged and fully absorbed like that. When one's a householder, then some other considerations may come in. Not to say that householders can't be fully engaged and fully absorbed, but I think we all know that. Isn't it? Do we or not? That some other considerations can very often get in, and it even may be hard to avoid them. So then these questions start arising about responsibilities on the material platform. I mean, generally speaking, we would certainly say that the devotees should just make every effort just to be fully absorbed, as householder or not, and that's really the best thing. But certainly when a person goes too far in that direction, then other considerations become important, actually, because they're kind of contacting the material energy.
So this instruction we talk about is rather more focused while not so much engaged.
It would seem, yeah, that they have like their own means. But sometimes Prabhupada spoke in the sense that he expected that householders would have their own means. Isn't it? Sometimes. Yeah. Anyway, this is the austerity for a householder. The different austerities in the different ashrams. The austerity for householders is charity. In general. Of course, you know, everyone's an individual. But in general, the austerity is charity. Any other comments or questions? Well, have you, in those cases, have you analyzed why they didn't take to devotional service? If you analyze, see, there's not much left in material life, in non-Krishna conscious life. There's not much left if you take out karma and you take out jnana, meaning in the broad senses of the terms. There's not much left. You know, generally, people will not take to devotional service, like in our experience, if they are too much on the material side. You know, they may express it in other ways sometimes. Sometimes. Like some, I mean, just to give it a fairly, like, not unusual example. In a temple, someone comes to the temple president or to some authority and says, all these brahmacharis, all they talk about is women. It's very bad. But in many cases, the problem is that his mind's thinking about women. And so, but if you go down to it, you know, the problem is that he's on the karma side. That's the problem. That's why he's disturbed. So, like, what reasons can you think of that people don't join, which don't seem to fit into... What about, like, if you say, well, they're Christians? But then, if you analyze, then you'll find that their attitudes towards Krishna consciousness as Christians, in many cases, have a lot to do with karma. Like, first of all, the feeling of pride and arrogance that we're the best. Now, if you're not best because you've got a better motor car, or a better house, or better clothes, then you can be best because you've got a better religion. So it's the same thing. It's basically a part of karma, part of material existence. So, and then if it's not that, or it's probably usually that to some extent, then otherwise there's a possibility that, well, you know, we like eating meat too much, and we couldn't even conceive of not eating meat. So again, it's on the karma side. So it may look like something else, but when you really get down to it, you end up with it being more on the karma side. It could also be a little bit on the jnana side. Karma. He was very much on the side of karma, but he got the mercy of a devotee. And that devotee was very clever. He was, you know, it depends also on the devotee. Like, if you take Lord Chaitanya as a devotee, he got the animals to become devotees, more or less, by chanting Hare Krishna. Now, we can't do that. Even Prabhupada couldn't do that. But Prabhupada made people Krishna conscious who we couldn't really make Krishna conscious. So Narada, he's so Krishna conscious and so clever that he engaged Dhruva in such a way that unknowingly Dhruva started engaging in devotional service. Just like Prabhupada, as an example, he encouraged the devotees to make the Hare Krishna record. So when the people listening to the radio heard the Hare Krishna record, they thought, you know, because Indian things were popular in those days, they thought, wow, you know, this is kind of far out. Sounds, you know, catchy or something like that. So that was great cleverness. They were actually being engaged in devotional service. So Narada, he was also very clever. Because see, Dhruva, he was Vedic. Very Vedic. So Narada engaged him in a Vedic process, which was acceptable to Dhruva. It was acceptable. So, but then it included some Krishna consciousness. So he very enthusiastically chanted Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, thinking, wow, I'm going to get my kingdom real soon through this mantra. But it purified his heart. So, you know, he was very strongly on the karma side, but on the other hand, he was very pious, meaning he was Vedic, very pious actually. So he wasn't just like a gross materialist that we may come across, who may think, ah, Krishna consciousness, I wouldn't touch it. Not like that. He was very pious in regard to religious activities, Vedic religious activities. So, you know, some sort of elements of qualification were there, along with Narada's expertise. Is that all right? Something like that. All right, any other comment or question? So we wish you the very best of luck with the test, or Krishna's mercy, Tuesday. I think I told you basically yesterday pretty much everything. But if you just go through, you've got a few days now, if you go through things, then I'm sure it should be okay. Yeah, but then we went through it all verbally. So that's sort of, I thought that should be sufficient. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Nana shastra vichara naika nipano Sadharma samstapaka Lokana mitakarino tribhuvane Manyo sharanya kara Radha Krishna padara vinda bhajana Nandena matalika Vande Rupa Sanatana Raghu Jaga Sri Jiva Gopalaka. I offer my respectful obeisances unto the six Goswamis, namely Sri Sanatana Goswami, Sri Rupa Goswami, Sri Raghunath Bhatta Goswami, Sri Raghunath Das Goswami, Sri Jiva Goswami, and Sri Gopal Bhatta Goswami, who are very expert in scrutinizingly studying all the revealed scriptures, with the aim of establishing eternal religious principles for the benefit of all human beings. Thus, they're honored all over the three worlds, and they're worth taking shelter of because they're absorbed in the mood of the gopis and are engaged in the transcendental loving service of Radha and Krishna. Shishad Goswami Prabhu Ki Jai. So last time, let's see, we've been discussing the purity of devotional service, how devotional service is not contaminated by karma and jnana. Or, there are different ways you can express this concept of karma and jnana. Karma and jnana, bhukti and mukti, dharma arta karma and moksha. These three phrases, they're each expressing the same idea. Basically, sense gratification, in one way or another, licit, illicit, ritualistic, or in any way, just sense gratification and liberation. We're not interested in sense gratification, are we, boys? No, definitely not. That's good. So we're in good company today here. So chapter 4 was talking about how devotional service, of course, particularly pure devotional service, is much better actually than jnana or liberation, and also karma, like that. Although the main theme was more along the lines of liberation, jnana, that devotional service is better. Then chapter 5 was discussing how devotional service is much better than karma. And even there were descriptions about how someone, at least someone who's on the level of pure devotional service, they don't have to worry about their material responsibilities in terms of their karma, the reactions of their previous activities, any obligations they may have to their parents, forefathers, society, any duties they may have in terms of varnashram. They transcend. A pure devotee particularly transcends all those things, so they can just forget about them. There's an interesting discussion, we'll come to it sooner or later in the Bhagavad Gita, well, later actually, right at the end. At the end of the 18th chapter, Krishna speaks, chapter 18, verse 66, Sarva Dharma Parichaja Mame Kam Sharanam Vraja Aham Tvam Sarva Pape Bhyo Moksha Eshami Masucha. Just give up all your dharmas. And, of course, this term dharma, or these dharmas, may be so many, but Krishna, according to our acharyas, is at least one type of dharma he's talking about there is like your ritualistic duties to the forefathers and so on. All the different duties you may have according to scripture on the material platform. So, Krishna, Arjuna is, according to Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, complaining that, but I have so many responsibilities, if I don't carry them out, I'm going to get bad reactions. Do you have to go? Okay, we'll see you later. All right. Several years later, perhaps. So, Arjuna is saying that I'm going to get reactions if I don't fulfill all these obligations which are described in scripture on the material platform. So Krishna says, actually, you should understand that when you surrender to me, you don't have to follow all those other rules and regulations, fulfill all the obligations. And Krishna says that it's me, it was me in the Vedic scriptures who said that you had to follow them, because the Vedas are being manifest from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Krishna says, it was me who was saying that you have to do these things, and now it's me telling you that you don't have to do them. And in fact, now that you understand about devotional service, if you don't do devotional service in the name of having to do all those other obligations, then you're going to incur sin. You follow the idea? Previously you would have committed sin and got so many reactions if you didn't do all those things which I said you had to do when I spoke the Vedas. But now that you know about surrendering, so now you must surrender. And now if you say, but I've got so many obligations so I can't surrender to Krishna, so now you'll get the same reactions for not surrendering and for doing those things. Anyway, so that's the idea, the purity of devotional service. It takes one right out of the whole sphere of material action and reaction. And everything becomes null and void. Everything on the material platform becomes null and void. As long as you are, or should we say, to the degree that you are surrendered, to the degree that you are a pure devotee, and like that. As Krishna says, as they surrender to me accordingly, I reward them accordingly. Krishna reciprocates accordingly. Any questions about all that? Sarup Siddhi Prabhu?
Yes. It's about that last point. If it's simple to answer, do it. But otherwise, we'll do it when we get to that verse. I don't quite understand when you say, when you do a certain duty, you don't incur reaction. that what you just said, if you don't do a superior duty, you incur again reaction.
Well, the thing is, Krishna is saying that you should surrender to me and give up all your other duties, which you would normally have, like looking after your parents, your debts to the government, your debts to other members of society, your debts to the forefathers. So Krishna, the thing is that for one who's on the material platform, then they have to fulfill all those obligations. Otherwise, they'll get reaction. You follow that idea? Okay. So now, in Bhagavad Gita 1866, Krishna is telling Arjuna that sarva dharman parichaja, all those duties, they're all part of dharma on the material level. But now Krishna is saying that you give up all those dharmas and mam ekam, sharanam braja. So Krishna is saying that now that you understand, previously you didn't understand, you were just on the material platform, so you had to do those duties. But now you understand that you should surrender. So now you should surrender. But if you say that I can't surrender because of all the duties, the point is that even though you go off and do those duties without surrendering, sort of like rejecting what Krishna says, then Krishna says that all the reactions that you would have got previously for not doing those duties, now you'll get those reactions for doing the duties and neglecting surrendering. Because now those duties become obstacles to surrendering. You follow the idea?
Yes. At the first stage, you get sinful reaction, don't you?
Yeah.
Do you get also sinful reaction in the second stage, although you don't perform?
Yes, well, Krishna's saying that if you don't, if you don't surrender to Krishna, then, because Krishna's saying that what is dharma? It is Krishna saying that whatever I say is dharma, is dharma. So previously I said that to do those things is dharma. Now I'm saying it's not dharma, but to surrender to me is dharma. And to do those things now in this context becomes adharma. You follow the idea? Okay? Any other question or comment? So let's go on to chapter 6. So now, chapter 6, how to discharge devotional service. So in chapter 2 was the beginning of the section or the part of, or should I say the wave, actually. The second wave of this first part of the ocean of the nectar of devotional service. So that second wave is sadhana bhakti. So chapter 2 was the beginning of that, and it gave a little outline. What is sadhana bhakti? What is vaidhi sadhana bhakti? And a little glimpse of what is raganuga sadhana bhakti. Then, chapter 3 was discussing who is eligible for taking up devotional service. In other words, it's sort of like, to some extent, considerations which are pre-sadhana bhakti, before sadhana bhakti. Anyway, it's sort of leading up to the discussion. Liberation and how devotional service is better. And in chapter 5, as we just said, is all about how devotional service is better than karma. So now, chapter 6, we're actually going to start going into the detailed discussion about sadhana bhakti. And it is very detailed. Actually, not just sadhana bhakti, but chapter 6 is beginning the discussion on vaidhi sadhana bhakti. After all, raganuga sadhana bhakti, as we know, is chapters 15 and 16. So chapter 6, then 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, and 14, they're all discussing vaidhi sadhana bhakti. And chapter 6 is going to tell us, after all, vaidhi sadhana bhakti means the practice, sadhana bhakti, the practice of devotional service according to vaidhi, according to rules and regulations. So chapter 6 is basically presenting the list of all the rules. Then 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and so on, 13, 14. Particularly 7 to 12. Also 13 and 14. They are going to discuss in detail every single one of the rules. Of course, we know what the main rule is, right? What's the main rule, Dr. Karin? Right, well done. That's the main rule. So that does not appear here, because we already learned that. But here we have actually a list of 64 rules. Prabhupada explains in the first paragraph how these rules are coming actually from Hari Bhakti Vilas. In other words, Hari Bhakti Vilas by Srila Sanatana Goswami is a more elaborate rule book. In fact, Hari Bhakti Vilas is basically a rule book. It's basically a rule book. So many rules, injunctions, do this, don't do that, and what the consequences are, and so on and so forth. So Prabhupada explains here, let's see. Srila Rupa Goswami states that his elder brother, Sanatana Goswami, has compiled Hari Bhakti Vilas for the guidance of the Vaishnavas, and therein has mentioned many rules and regulations to be followed by the Vaishnavas. Some of them are very important and prominent. And Srila Rupa Goswami will now mention these very important items for our benefit. In other words, this is a selection of rules and regulations from Hari Bhakti Vilas, which is like the complete collection. But this is particularly the selection of the most important ones. Let's stay with it, boys. Anyone who's not staying with it. Okay? Let's try and keep our heads above water. So, in other words, Hari Bhakti Vilas has many, many, many more rules. In fact, an astonishing number of rules. But Rupa Goswami wants just to select those which are particularly important. So it's very kind of him, and here they are, and there's 64 of them. A further point is made here. Prabhupada says, the purport of this statement is that Srila Rupa Goswami proposes to mention only basic principles and not details. And then an interesting understanding of that idea. For example, a basic principle is that one has to accept a spiritual master. Exactly how one follows the instructions of a spiritual master is considered a detail. For example, if one is following the instruction of a spiritual master and that instruction is different from the instructions of another spiritual master, this is called detailed information. But the basic principle of acceptance of a spiritual master is good everywhere, although the details may be different. Srila Rupa Goswami does not wish to enter into details here, but wants to place before us only the principles, and the meaning the main principles. So this is a very important and relevant point. I think it's pretty much self-explanatory, really. One thing we should understand, though, is that it's not that, like within ISKCON, we have there are many spiritual masters, and each one is a person, and each one, at least to some extent, you know, it's not like they all do exactly the same thing under the same circumstances, and it's not that they would all just give the same instructions in the same circumstances. In some cases, some variations would be there in instructions. This is only natural. But this is within a certain context. And that context is, you know, like what is bona fide and really correct in Krishna consciousness, according to Srila Prabhupada. So it's not that we can think that, you know, some Babaji next door who's singing Bhajan Nitai Gaur Radhe Shyam Hare Krishna Hare Rama, I mean, to take it to an extreme, that he can come along and give another instruction, and we can say, well, you know, it's just different, it's a detail. But here he's a spiritual master, so I'm following him, and so it's okay. It doesn't work like that. There are certain parameters, and basically they have been defined by Srila Prabhupada, actually. For example, Prabhupada didn't even appreciate so many of his own godbrothers and people associated with his own godbrothers, because even though in a certain sense we could say that, well, they're sort of bona fide Gaudiya Vaishnavas or something like that, but Prabhupada didn't really take them like that. So in this context here, when we talk about detailed instructions of a spiritual master, as opposed to more general principles, then we should understand that the general principle is, that the first general principle is, Krishna consciousness as taught by Srila Prabhupada. And not that we can just opt for anyone who's meant to be a spiritual master in the Gaudiya line, perhaps, or something like that. You get the idea? So it may be a detail, like in one situation a devotee may be told that, you know, do this service, and in the same situation another devotee with a different spiritual master might be told to do something somewhat different, but all within the context of Prabhupada's instructions, how to practice Krishna consciousness. So that's how we should really understand this concept here. We had a rather amusing experience once. We went to Varasana, and there's a very nice place, some of you may know it, at the bottom of the hill called Radha Bagh. You know Radha Bagh, any of you? Garden. Very nice garden, down the bottom of the hill, on the way to Uchagan, actually, just somewhere on that side. So we went there, it was a VIHE parikrama, and we went there for breakfast. And some of the devotees were very new to India, and they couldn't imagine that they would see any Vaishnavas, Gaudiya Vaishnavas, with dhotis, tilak on, and sikas and shaved heads and everything, smoking ganja. And we walked into this little ashram, Radha Bagh, and there they were. And there was this one big ganja tree, it must have been about 6 feet or 7 feet tall. They just pulled it out of the ground and they were drying it there. So some of the devotees started lecturing them that you can't do this. This is not Vaishnav. Prabhupada never said you could do this, or something like that. And these little Babajis were quite shocked. And they said, well, your guru says that you can't do it, but our guru says that we can do it. So the devotees just didn't know what to say. I mean, they're new just to these things. But it's not like that, that someone can just say, you know, someone is supposedly a guru or some sort of spiritual figure. Not within our, like, strictly speaking, our line, the line of Prabhupada. And they may say, oh, you can do this. And we may think, oh, well, I guess we can, because he's meant to be, you know, someone important, so I guess we can. No. The general sort of the boundaries, which we don't go over, the general boundaries are laid out by Srila Prabhupada. But within those boundaries, then in certain particular circumstances, an authority or guru may say do this, but another may say do that. And in that sense, these are details, and we know that we stick with our respective spiritual masters and like that. Okay. Any questions about that? I wouldn't expect there would be so much. Okay. So, now we get our rules. What, two, three, about 3.5 pages of rules, 64 of them. So,
so there's 64 rules, and they're divided up into different groups. The first 10, they are important do's. Right, you get the idea? Important things which you must do. Then the second 10, and it's just a matter, in a sense, it's a matter of looking at them and it becomes apparent. They are important do-nots. then there's the remaining 44. Okay. So just write this down, this is important. Now of the 10, of the first 10 do's, Prabhupada says three. The first three are most important. Okay. They are the most important out of the whole lot. Out of the final 44, Prabhupada says the last five are very important. Not most, but very. So obviously most includes very. So very important means they're not as important as the first three, which are most important.